Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, powered by First National. I am Adam Pawatic, sitting here with Aaron Cameron at the Real Capital Conference. It's one of Aaron's mind's favorite because, of course, it does focus on capital.
All our friends are here.
Yeah, everybody. Just the whole club's together. It's fantastic. Our guest today is John Peets, Vice President, Head of Leasing, GTA for Oxford Properties Group. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to jump into John's background, but the topic of the conversation today is going to be office leasing. I mean, we're in the biggest office market in the country. John will get into it, but Oxford's likely one of the largest, if not the largest, you know, office holders here. So he's going to have a great view on where we are. I mean, obviously, people spend a lot of time. Everybody's got an opinion right now on return to office and all that, but this gentleman would be more than qualified to speak on it. So that's why this will be a little different. John, let's jump into it. Your background, how'd you get into real estate? How'd you end up this massive real estate portfolio to take care of?
Well, back in the late 80s, I had a summer job with Cadillac Fairview because my brother-in-law was the head of leasing at the time. So while I was completing my degree, I would do all kinds of Joe jobs for the sales team at Cadillac Fairview. And so, yeah, it was absolutely being in the right place, right time in terms of the opportunity. Didn't have to really go through a very comprehensive interview process. And it's not that my brother-in-law hired me. He actually left the business, left Cadillac Fairview, and I was hired by his successor. So it was kind of nice in that regard. I had a person who believed in me and that saw me kind of interact with everybody during the summertime while I was interning there. And yeah, one thing led to another. And 34 years later, I'm loving the real estate business and having a lot of fun and met some amazing people over the years, as you talked about, mentors and really interesting markets that I've been through in terms of the, you know, the early 90s recessions and the 9/11 crisis. You know, you talk about the great financial crisis in 2008. So, you know, seen a lot of interesting markets. And you were asking about a story. I thought it would be funny to share with you kind of a young person's view of the world and, you know, how impetuous sometimes we can be. And so one day I was in Peter Sharpe's office, who was at one point, he was the chief operating officer of Cadillac Fairview. He went on to become the CEO of the company. But in the period of time that I'm talking about, which would have been the, you know, the mid-90s, Bruce Duncan was brought in from JMB out of Chicago to kind of breathe new life into Cadillac Fairview and really to take the company public. So I was sitting in Peter Sharpe's office, and back then those offices were 500 square feet, not 150 square feet like they are today. And there might have been an ashtray on his desk too for cigars and that sort of thing after hours. But in sitting there talking to Peter about a transaction that I was working on at the TD Center, and it was a large enough transaction that he was interested in it and it was going to move the needle. Bruce Duncan walked into the room and leans over my shoulder and says to Peter, "Where's the PSA on 415 Young? And I looked over my shoulder and, you know, in a kind of a cheeky kind of way, I just said, "We're buying 415 Young Street?" And because it was so out of character with Cadillac Fairview brand and image. And he said, "Yeah, we're buying 415 Yonge Street." And I looked at him again and I said, "Why are we buying 415 Yonge Street?" And he has these steely blue eyes and he looks at me and he says, "To make money." So that principle still holds true today, no matter what market you're in, you're trying to make money, right?
It answers a lot of questions.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, that was a funny experience. But no, lots of really interesting ups and downs and recessions and buoyant markets and, you know, just a ton of fun. You know, that's what I love about the industry, right? And I love about my job and my role at Oxford is, you know, no day is the same. Everything is quite dynamic and very much a reflection of the economy.
How long have you been at Oxford for?
This will be my 19th year. I started back in 2004. I was in brokerage. Previous to that, I was with Cushman & Wakefield or Royal LePage at the time, Royal LePage Commercial. And then prior to that, if I'm going back in time, it was Trizac Hahn, it was Cadillac Fairview. I worked at Cadillac Fairview twice, actually. So right out of university, like I said, I started working with Cadillac. Then I went to Brookfield Properties for 6 years and had the pleasure and the privilege of leasing Brookfield Place. Very interesting stories there in terms of, you know, how those properties came to be and their financial performance, which first tower was fantastic. 161 Bay made lots of money on its initial lease up. Second tower, not so much. And we can talk about that.
Would the date stamps of each one of those define why you're making money on one and not the other? Is that?
Yeah. One was brought on and pre-leased in, you know, the late 80s. There was a lot of froth. Then, of course, in the early 90s, when the other tower was launched, it was at the very beginning of a protracted recession. I think you might have remembered John Love uttering the word survive till 95. You know, we were in the depths of a long recession. So that property had a significant amount of leasing to do. We kicked the building off with 10% pre-lease commitment from Lang Mishner. And it was a tough slog for the rest of the 1.2 million square feet to lease for the remainder of the building. So yeah, not good timing, right? Everything in life is about good timing and being in the right place.
You mentioned 500 square foot offices. Do you wish that was still the case today? Would it make your job a little easier if everybody demanded 500 square feet?
Yeah, it certainly would. No, you know, the whole notion of the office and the workplace is, it has to change. You know, there's so much going on in terms of, you know, how to bring people back to the office. And certainly, I think pre-pandemic, you would see that the office or the workplace in general was failing its employees. There were a number of different factors that would indicate that, you know, things like, you know, not enough adequate meeting space, not enough space for people to do the different activities that they wanted to do. You know, this whole notion of activity-based work, you know, kind of came about just prior to the pandemic and was being executed by groups like Deloitte and others, you know, these large institutions that were trying to accommodate large numbers of people. But, you know, there were lots of acoustic issues. There were lots of, you know, just work styles or workplace decor and furniture and IT. So there were a lot of pain points that were preceding this pandemic. But now I think, you know, employers have recognized this and they're starting to really think about how to build a better mousetrap. And we're obviously trying to help them in that regard.
So what's the hottest new trend in office that can be the tool to get, you know, people back on Mondays or Fridays? You know, that's probably the challenge now. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, everybody's in. Monday, Friday, no.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, from a structural point of view, I just don't see the office going back to a 5-day a week rhythm again. I think, you know, we're in that hybrid world. We're never going back. I think it was Leisman that said 80% of organizations are providing their employees with hybrid options. And
unless you own office buildings, you likely are not.
Yeah. Truth be told, you know, Oxford has a very adult-like way to approach this as opposed to a firm mandate. But we've approached it on the basis of we're an office-centric company, obviously. But if your team leader or your manager believes that, you know, it's more effective for there to be flexibility, they'll offer that to their teams. So there's not a sort of a heavy draconian.
Thinking of the King Sets and the Allies of the world, which are all just 5 days a week.
Yeah, my group, my team loves and wants to be together and wants to be in the office. And of course, when you're leasing space, you have to be there because things happen at the drop of a hat. You need to be, you know, able to respond to brokers or tenants, you know, tour requests or meeting requests. So we're constantly at the office, our group, but there's definitely other groups that have the freedom and the flexibility. And it's really is a function of how the offices are set up, right? I mean, sometimes open concept just does not meet the needs of individual workers and they want that quiet time. They want that focus time so they can do that at home.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the hybrid concept is very attractive, I think, for most people, depending on their situation at home. I've got young kids, so I prefer to be in the office just solely based on that.
Good thing your wife doesn't listen to
this podcast. No, she does. That's okay. She knows it. What I thought was an interesting line of questioning for you, is it annoying or frustrating or is it a welcome change that all of a sudden everybody has an opinion about what you're an expert in? All of a sudden, this back to office is headline news. Everybody thinks they know the answer. Is that fun for you? Because now at the dinner table or the cocktail parties, you can have this conversation versus before. I was like, oh, office leasing. Interesting. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And people do have opinions about it, obviously, because we're all earning our livings in one way, shape, or form connected to our built environment. So yeah, no, it is very fascinating because there's no one silver bullet. There's no right answer. You know, each organization, each team are different. So you're going to have a mix of responses. And I think that's what makes it very interesting and it provides texture to the world that we live in.
Sort of cut you off, pivot for you. Because before, everybody was in 9 to 5, 5 days a week. I mean, there's a little bit of work from home noise. But the most interesting thing about office space, and correct me if I'm wrong, was really you're trying to cut down on the people per square foot and kind of cram more people in and make it more efficient
space. Yeah, that's where hoteling and activity-based work came into play. So we were experimenting with the whole hybrid notion prior to. I know Scotiabank was. I know Deloitte was. I mean, there are many, many organizations the world over that were experiencing, you know, a new way of working and trying to maximize their footprint. But back to your question about, you know, what brings people back or what are some of the more effective ways of bringing people back at. Again, it all comes back to the human being, I think, and providing them with the amenities that they have at home. A lot of people want the same functionality that they have at home. So quick access to good quality food and beverage.
I can wear my pajamas. Yeah.
If you so choose. As long as they're Maple Leaf logo.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, you're all right. No, and certainly fitness, right? Health and wellness is a huge contributor. I was in the gym the other day, and I often interact with people, just ask them questions about, you know, how's it going? They were talking about coding and, you know, this group of five young guys and having a great conversation. And I interjected and said, so do you guys, would you rather do that at home or would you rather do it here at the office? And they said, the only reason we come to the office is we love this gym, you know, and it happened to be in one of our buildings, which is part and parcel with the strategy of trying to bring or support employers to bring their employees back. You know, prior to the pandemic, Toronto wasn't, you know, embracing the same level of amenitization that you did have in, say, cities like Vancouver or Calgary. Calgary always had a fitness facility, a conference facility in their AA or AAA building.
And that would be fitness as an amenity, not just you put a tenant in that offers fitness services.
Right. In this particular case, we did an RFP. We selected a provider that will provide a high level of health and wellness, but at the same time, it's subsidized through operating costs. And the actual employee would only pay a very small fee, nominal fee of $40 a month. So, you know, you're getting classes, spin classes, yoga classes, you know, boot camp classes, all of the traditional workout facilities. And we found a real uptick in membership really since January. Not because necessarily due to New Year's resolutions, but we're still seeing the staying power and the growth in those numbers. So we're happy about that.
Did Toronto lag the rest of the country just because of the competitiveness here? There wasn't a need. The tenants weren't demanding it. So the, you know, the owner.
You're talking pre-pandemic.
Yeah, talking about the amenitization. You know, you can see reference that we didn't have the same level. I'm just curious why that is.
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess, you know, owners of property felt like if you wanted to engage with that kind of an amenity, you'd pay for it yourself. So as a, you know, person that enjoys fitness, you know, I went over to Equinox at Commerce Court West.
Where you could get what you wanted,
but
not for $40 a month.
No, no. You know, that's all changing. You know, there was a heavy emphasis on food and beverage in Toronto, right? That seemed to really drive.
As long as you had a Moxie's or Earl's or Cactus Club somewhere nearby, that's all that mattered.
Yeah, exactly.
We're so predictable.
Right? Yeah.
So what is happening now? I mean, we're in 2023. We're in a hybrid working environment. Let's say everybody's kind of coming in 2-3 days a week for the most part, you know, plus or minus a day or two.
In fact, 59% globally is the number that Leisman uses.
And we're a little bit behind, I think, North America, right?
59% represents
the number of days that people are in the office. So it was broken down. I can't remember the exact breakdown, but 31% would be in the office 3 days or more. 20-some-odd% would be in the office 2 days or more.
Okay.
And then 41% would be in the office 1 day or less. So that number, you know, has been increasing, according to Leisman. So really, it's a function of, you know, what are companies doing about it and what can they do about it? I think, you know, when you look at the employment market is dictating how companies are responding. We were talking about it this morning. You know, technology companies have cut back in terms of some of their employment levels, obviously. But at the same time, I don't think they want to impose a back to office mandate because I think it'll just be moving people around from one company to another with a lot of costs associated with that. So I think rather than losing those people because you force them to do something that you ultimately want, you know, it's better to just treat them like adults and let them make the decisions. And look, I think it all comes down to, you know, is it a competitive advantage for us to permit our employees to work flexibly? I think the moment it stops being a competitive advantage, they're losing people to firms that, you know, have 500 square foot offices or better facilities, higher quality facilities. I think that'll start to change and or when the employer has the balance of power back.
So then the crux becomes, assume that leadership around the world, Canada in particular, will focus on GTA because that's where we are and that's your expertise, wrap their heads around the fact that hybrid is here to stay. And so it is 2 to 3 days a week or whatever the number ends up being, but it's some sort of flexibility. Your office use is now declined by the inverse, right? Let's say it's 60% in the office compared to what it was pre-pandemic. You got 40% less office use. I mean, I know that's not exactly one-to-one. What do you do? How are we going to adopt, how to adapt to that reality?
Well, you know, I think it's a free market and I think companies will vote with their feet. And we're seeing that. We're seeing a massive flight to quality. Our vacancy would be under 10%. It would be around 9%.
Is it outperforming market by 300-400 beeps at least, right?
Oh, depends on what you're measuring it against. I mean, the broader market would be 17-18% available. We're sitting at 9% with very little kind of exposure in the next several years. And that has to do with a whole bunch of other factors, quality of the buildings, the location of the buildings, the way they're managed, the way their capital is invested, you know? So we have a distinct advantage in that regard. And I would say that, you know, that's what's going to happen foreseeable future. I think we are going to win at the expense of low quality A, B, and C buildings and companies that are outside of the downtown. I think the downtown has a phenomenal advantage over the suburbs. I mean, some might say, well, the suburbs will attract people because it's close to their homes. But look, I think if you think about the demographic makeup of people that are working in the towers downtown, it's millennials and Gen Zs. You know, 75% of the office working population by 2025 will be millennials and Gen Zs. And so it's all about, you know, the convenience of the office and the quality of that office. And so, you know, as we move forward, I just think that there's going to be naturally, you know, a persistent high level of vacancy in the lesser quality buildings, and the high quality buildings will reap the benefits of, you know, making the investment, either, you know, retrofitting their buildings and or, you know, being fortunate enough to built in the past 10 years.
Are you seeing that trend starting? I know it's going to take a long time just because of the duration of office leasing, but is the sublet market starting to indicate that pivot?
Well, look, I mean, the biggest sublets that have attracted a lot of media attention would be Shopify's sublet in The Well. You know, and another large sublet, maybe not media worthy, but, you know, LifeWorks at 16 York Street. Deloitte had 100,000 square feet in Bay Adelaide North, and that is now leased by the IROC Investment Regulation Authority. So, you know, look, some discerning companies are going to see the opportunity of being in a brand new building, whether it's The Well or whether it's 16 York. I think the distinct advantage 16 York and some of these large sublets that are built out space will have is that exactly that. Your space is move-in ready versus Shopify, which has base building condition to offer its prospective subtenants. That's going to be difficult. They're going to have
to. It wouldn't be attractive to some tenants, starting with a clean slate?
It may be. And in our case, you know, we've done some recent transactions at 161 Bay, the best building in the country. They've started from scratch. And, you know, that brings up a whole myriad of other questions around the cost of construction and how are companies, you know, addressing that with the high interest rate environment that we're in or the high cost of capital. But, you know, on the sublet front, I just want to finish off on that. You know, those sublets, they will lease. They're very attractive buildings. They're very attractive opportunities. You know, they're fully turnkeyed and ready to go. And 85% of all the transactions in 2022 in downtown Toronto were in built premises. So, you know, there is something to be said about being able to create your own culture and your own identity through the fit and finish. But in a lot of cases, they can make some minor adjustments and make it their own.
Are you competing with sublease space within your own portfolio?
It's a great question. We only have about 3% of our portfolio attributed to sublease premises. It's not a big factor for us. And you know what? When it has become an issue, the good news on that side of it is we've attracted some great quality tenants. So, you know, just as an example, at 85 Richmond, we had a company called Touch Bistro that Omer's invested in. And, you know, they bit off more than they could chew. And they've sublet to great companies. Pinterest is one of them. You know, they've brought a whole new demographic, a whole new group of people that, you know, have energized the asset. So we love that. And we're going to, you know, obviously, if our luck holds out, we'll be able to renew them and extend them and keep them as a customer.
We're almost done. Yep. We started off talking about amenities. Let's finish there. You mentioned gyms. What other kind of amenification, if that's a word, are you seeing kind of coming? And what do you predict over the next couple of years?
Well, my big belief is our industry needs to transform itself. We need to become more hotel-like. We need to adopt a hospitality mentality. We cannot be passive. We have to move to that next stage. That's what people want. They want a curated experience. Think about your own personal choices you make when you consume products or when you consume services. You know, you want that extra attention. You want that feeling of being, you know, very important. And so I think our industry needs to really bear down on the whole notion of hospitality and deliver it and move away from classifying buildings as class B, class A, class AA, AAA, and move to a four-star, five-star experience, you know, because I think that's really what it's all about. It's about the employee experience. The other area I would say specifically would be space as a service. I do believe that with the hybrid notion and with, you know, shrinking of footprints like we're seeing in the UK with HSBC, and you have other examples of it here in Toronto, we're going to see a lot more of that. And at the same time, I think space as a service will fill the void for the flexibility that companies need to provide their people and or, you know, for new businesses to flourish and expand. And so I think we'll see more space as a service offerings in better quality buildings because it is considered an amenity if you can pair it up with conference facilities and other offerings that they have. So I think that's an important aspect of it.
You mentioned shrinking footprints. You know, I come into the office 3 or 4 days a week, but on the Friday when I'm not there, in my office is, you know, it's not, the office space isn't being used.
Right.
So the company still needs as much square feet for me, regardless of whether I'm a 5 day a week person or a three.
Yeah.
If I was a one, then Aaron might kick me out of my desk, but you know, if I'm coming in. So if you're talking about shrinking footprints, you know, other than hoteling has a capacity to absorb some of that slack, how damaging is it to have people coming in only 3 or 4 days a week to overall demand for office space?
I mean, it's like the church, right? You build the church for Easter and Christmas, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd say the same thing applies in the case of office. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is when you're going to get peak occupancy. I do believe there's winners and losers in all of this, you know, and we're going to see the lesser quality buildings lose out to the better quality buildings. You know, shrinking footprint is a reality, but things change. Everything changes. You know, 5 years from now, we can make projections about what that's going to look like. And I know we're going to be wrong, and I know the experts are going to be precisely wrong.
Exactly right. Wrong.
So, you know, I do believe there's going to be great pressure, but that's where we need to put emphasis on our ability to transform the assets if they need to be transformed and amenitize them greatly in order to bring folks back and to make that experience commute worthy. I mean, I think that's a phrase that's been used quite regularly now. You really have to get over that hump of the obstacle of not wanting to come in because of this long commute. Toronto's traffic is third worst in North America. We need to do something about that, obviously, at a municipal level. And we need to make our transit system safe so that people feel comfortable coming into the office. But I do believe that, you know, businesses is an organism. You know, it's going to grow naturally. You know, you might shrink today, like, you know, cutting back a plant, you know, you're going to make that plant smaller, but it'll grow back, you know, over time. And whether it's physical growth or virtual growth, or both, you're going to see that over time, you know, there's great resilience in the Toronto office market. And we've been through these bumpy rides before, like I said, whether it was, you know, some of these great recessions we've been through or some of these geopolitical or existential threats that we've had over the last 30 years.
I think that's a great note to end on. John, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks to First National for powering the podcast. And of course, thanks to our friends at Real Estate Forum for hosting us here at Real Capital. Thanks again, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario License Number 10514 and 11252.